Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Amanda Vinicky. Chicago's mayor apologizes to black residents.
The very institutions in which we represent today have harmed black people.
Mayor Brandon Johnson gets the ball rolling on reparations.
So they stay in America, but in the shadows, living in constant fear of deportation without the ability to legally work.
President Biden moves to protect Dreamers and longtime undocumented immigrants married to U.S. citizens.
I have traveled all around our state to help our fellow Republicans rescue Illinois from the leftist Governor Pritzker.
Instead of defeating Democrats, Illinois Republicans seem intent on fighting each other. Less than a month out from the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. The former president says he'll be there, not Chicago, during the RNC.
Probably they think because I have a hotel there, I have a beautiful hotel there, beauty, as good as it gets, but I'm staying here.
Breaking onto the school scene, the contest for a seat on Chicago's first ever elected school board begins. And the U.S. Supreme Court's latest opinion could bring more protections to Illinois domestic violence victims.
And now to our Week in Review panel. Promise, they're as good as it gets. Joining us are Brandon Pope from WCIU, Rima Amin from Chalk Beat Chicago, Jake Sheridan from the Chicago Tribune, and Hannah Meisel from Capital News Illinois. Now, let's get to it. Hannah, going to you. The Illinois Republican Party is in chaos. The chairman of the state party, that is, Don Tracy, quitting. Now, this is just weeks ahead of really the biggest event ever for the Republicans, the National Convention. Just weeks away. So what is going on? Why is he stepping down?
This is not a huge surprise. You know, perhaps the timing, definitely. You wouldn't necessarily want chaos just weeks before having to have a show of unity. But, you know, Don Tracy, he's been head of the state party for 3.5 years now, and it has not been a smooth 3 years. You know, basically, he is just not the person that the hardliner conservatives who have gained power within the state party wanted. And, you know, 2022, that election cycle, his first at the helm, not a very good one for Republicans in Illinois. And this one, you know, Republicans are just very, very divided over what the way forward should be. And as I said, more hardliners getting power within the party, and they want people who are not pragmatic. They want people who pass the purity tests and people who are willing to be the happy warriors in this culture war.
What is the purity test? Is it, do you back President Donald Trump? What is it?
I mean, it's that and more, though. You know, it's, have you ever... You know, Jeannie Ives, who, you know, remember back in 2018.
Conservative firebrand. Yes. She ran to be Illinois' nominee for governor and
right.
then narrowly defeated by Bruce Rauner, who went on to lose to Pritzker.
Right, right. You know, she had maybe thrown in her hat in the ring to become the new chair. Mm-hmm. And some of these folks on the right are saying, well, she had a picture with Bruce Rauner back in 2018, mere months before. And it's just like...
And that was too much.
Yes. And so Mark Shaw, who he had... also, he had attempted to be the state party chair back in 2018, and narrowly lost, and as kind of a consolation, he was given vice chair. Earlier this week, the state central committee kicked him out of that position, even though he's also on the state central committee. So I remember when he was extremely conservative, and now he's just not... you know, in line with what these people want.
So really an entire shift. Now, what does this mean, Brandon, for, I'm not going to, we'll ask Hannah, you think about what it means for the Illinois Republican Party. I want to know what this means for the rest of Illinois. Does it matter?
I think ultimately it does a little bit for those who, you know, want to have conservative voices or are passionate about conservative voices having a place. If the party that's, you know, in charge of making sure that Republicans have a chance in a very blue state can get their house in order, then the candidates you want to see may not be there for you when you go to the ballot. And so that's ultimately the impact on the voters.
Really sort of solidifying this one-party rule?
Yeah.
Is that your expectation?
I think it definitely solidifies the one-party rule. And we're seeing the Democratic Party of Illinois celebrating and saying, hey, look at these guys. They're not unified. We are.
Yeah, what did you make of that? Really, the Illinois Democrats were, like, euphoric over this. And in a statement said that they don't expect the new leadership to change the anti-choice, anti-worker, pro-Trump policies, that is. But they, quote, wish the best of luck to the inevitable MAGA extremists who will succeed Don Tracy as chair. Jake, do you think they mean that? Do they really wish him luck?
No, I doubt they wish him luck.
So why put out a statement like that?
Well, you know, I think they're celebrating that the Republicans are fighting among themselves and not fighting Democrats. You know, that obviously creates a better lane for Democrats. There's a less serious opposition to the party in power, to the Democrats, when the Republicans are fighting among themselves.
Now, Anna, I know you care passionately about government in general, not from a partisan point of view, but is this sort of a sign of deeper polarization? And is this what Illinois, frankly, maybe deserves, this sort of disarray? And can you explain?
I mean, we've been moving toward this for a very long time. The Washingtonization, polarization of politics has come to Illinois, even though leaders in both parties had tried to fend it off. It's a bigger wave that they could control. You know, Democrats, of course, control both the Illinois House, the Illinois Senate, all of the constitutional officers, the Illinois Supreme Court. It is total control of Democrats in Illinois. They have no use for the Republican Party except for to use them as a punching bag. And, you know, Republicans, they have, you know, been frankly irrelevant, especially since Bruce Rauner left office. And the money is just not there either. And that's, you know, part
of
this.
So is this going to change anything?
No. I don't really think so. You know, nationally, it's not like any Republicans nationally look toward the Illinois Republican Party for any pointers. You know, whoever gets in to replace Don Tracy, I would imagine a more conservative voice. You know, they'll maybe amp up their attacks, but in terms of money, in terms of support, in terms of winning any seats, I don't see that happening.
I think it just deepens the crater, really. I mean, you look at places like DuPage County, which used to reliably be Republican strongholds, and ever since 2008, now the Republican Party there has shrunk to where there's only one GOP representative on their city or county board. So, the reality on the ground is you're going to have less Republican representation because a move farther to the right in a blue state like Illinois isn't going to help those politicians float to the top and win any elected races.
And now, speaking of the Republican National Convention, again, this chaos comes really at, one might think, maybe an inopportune time. Maybe it's great. You can sort of crystallize the new leadership ahead of the convention. But this comes as Donald Trump, supposedly, according to reports here, including from a Chicago television station, was going to actually stay, instead of in Milwaukee, in the city of Chicago for the RNC because he had called Milwaukee, quote, horrible. Now, does this hurt Trump and the GOP in Wisconsin? I mean, it's a battleground state. Rima?
I think when you talk about a candidate like Donald Trump, you kind of throw out the conventional wisdom of what's palatable to say, and I think I don't think it's probably, I feel as though probably his party members didn't think that was a great thing to say about the city that is literally holding the convention that is going to nominate him for president. But I also, you know, I think that he kind of flies by the seat of his pants, and people, you know,
and it's what people appreciate.
People appreciate that. He has a whole voter base that appreciates that, and I think that's kind of expected.
It's part of the challenge for him, though, is Trump has a base, a fervent base, but it's fixed. And so the problem he has electorally is he needs to grow that base. Comments like that in a battleground state like Wisconsin, it kind of limits you a little bit for those independents out there who may have been considering that, and
sure,
they maybe live in Milwaukee or the
point.
Suburbs there, and they're thinking, wow, you think that bad about my community I care about? Why are you even here?
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch his delegates kind of scramble to explain what he meant when he called the city horrible. You know, there's been a bunch of different explanations,
yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know in Chicago we get hyper offended when anybody disses Chicago, mm-hmm. Right?
In some ways, this is a compliment from Donald Trump about our city.
But also, Chicago has been one of his favorite punching bags over the years, too. And so I thought.
But now he loves us.
Well,
summertime shy.
At least to stay.
Summertime shy.
I think he tried to have a rally many years ago during his first run for president.
Right.
And the protests got so bad that he actually, he canceled the
this
rally.
This is the city
downtown.
That chased him off, the
yeah.
one city that did it.
Yeah. So.
Well, we are gearing up for coverage of all of that, the Illinois Republican Party, former President Trump's campaign and all of that. But let's turn instead to city politics, because we have a sort of a new form of running for office that is being pushed by Alderman Matt Martin of the 47th Ward. And Jake, this is wanting to use taxpayer money to actually run for a seat on the city council. Why is he pushing this now?
Yeah, so this is an idea from Matt Martin to try to take some of the wealthy donors who affect politics all across our country out of Chicago politics to some extent, to give more power, in theory, to everyday voters by allowing politicians running for the city council to rely less on those donations. What it would do is it would allow aldermanic candidates to opt into a program where, if they qualify by raising enough money from at least 60 donors in their ward, 100 donors, a total of 17,000, they could get up to $200,000 more from the city based on how much more they raise. And that would, Matt Martin says, allow aldermanic candidates to go door to door, to spend more time talking with voters, trying to get those small donations, instead of trying to go to business leaders or even unions to try to get bigger checks.
Hannah, what do you see this doing? Do you believe that you would be able to really bypass some of the more entrenched big money interests if you were able to have candidates receive taxpayer money? Worry less about that.
Well, it's certainly an interesting idea. I think we've also heard about this idea in Springfield over the years, too, not that it's ever gone anywhere. You know, the idea that you are more accountable to the voters if you're not, you know, receiving and relying on big money. But, you know, I'm not sure that it's going to go anywhere. I think in Jake's story, he illustrated the high barrier that it would have to cross.
And why is that, Jake?
Well, it was DNP'd. So this passed in committee, but it's now been stalled. The mayor hasn't really. Oh, my bad. I was talking about the wrong piece of legislation there. It's been sent to the Rules Committee, so it was stalled in that way. But and it's going to be a challenge to gain aldermanic support.
It's stalled when you look at sort of just the process. But behind that, why is it stalled?
Well, there's been some pushback to an extent from. There's been some infighting between Mayor Johnson and Alderman Matt Martin.
Even though this is Mayor Johnson picked Martin as chair of the Ethics Committee, you would think this would be something that they'd have spoken about. He's a progressive mayor.
Yeah, and to Johnson's credit, you know, he has shown support on the campaign trail for public financing of campaigns. But Martin and Johnson have gone back and forth a bit over another piece of legislation from Martin that would codify an executive order from Ron Emanuel that would block lobbyist donations to mayoral candidates. Johnson has pushed back against that effort, and it's also been stalled.
Why not? That seems like just a sort of good government thing that folks like to hear on the campaign trail and that we've often heard from candidates, right? Yeah.
Well, on one hand, the reason that Martin is trying to codify this legislation is because Johnson received donations from lobbyists last year. When that case, which violated the executive order, apparently, went up for the ethics board, the ethics board said they couldn't enforce that executive order.
Because there wasn't an ordinance.
Mm-hmm. So Matt Martin went and tried to create an ordinance. Johnson has said that he thinks that the ordinance should be broader, that Martin should focus on more sweeping legislation, including public financing.
So saying we want you to go further. No, Brandon, I want you to weigh in on this. Does this seem as if make it bigger is a way of making it nothing, or that's truly, hey, take an opportunity, really run with it versus going piecemeal?
It sounds like a little bit of a dodging, you know, and trying to back off the issue as much as possible, because, as you mentioned, there are special interests and lobbyists that are being supporting Mayor Brandon Johnson, and will support other candidates in the future. So I think ultimately it's going to be a tough sell for a lot of politicians. It may be a tough sell for taxpayers as well, being taxpayer money for candidates that they're candidates. They're not actually in office yet. So I'm fascinated to see how it plays out. It's been done in smaller cities for sure, but a city of this size, this would be one of the first big cities to do something like this.
And now moving on to another potential use of taxpayer money, and this is that Mayor Brandon Johnson forming a task force to really figure out how the city of Chicago could move forward and do something about reparations. Now, Jake, task force, often this is seen, again, as sort of a delay tactic. You form a task force, say that you're taking action, and let the task force talk, talk, and talk.
Yeah, you know, Lori Lightfoot pushed after 2020 to have a subcommittee in the city council that was studying reparations too. That went nowhere.
Is this different?
Yet another task force. To some extent, yes. You know, there's some money behind this to support people as they do this work. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that, you know, the language that Mayor Johnson uses when he talks about reparations here is the language he uses when he talks about every policy that he makes. You know, he talks about the historic disinvestment in Black communities in Chicago and the South and West Sides. And that's a focus for him in a whole lot of his policies. So, you know, it's
really
hard
embedded
to,
in his sort of every
absolutely.
Stance.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's hard to tell what a task force would do and what it could do. You know, a similar a reparations program that exists already in Evanston is currently in courts because a conservative group said it violates the 14th Amendment. So it's hard to predict what this could actually do. But I think the spirit of this reparations project is you know, something that really could affect the administration more and more.
And we did hear in the beginning from the mayor saying that institutions, including the mayor's office, city council, have themselves harmed Black people. And for that, he said, I'm sorry.
And so on behalf of the city of Chicago, I apologize for the historic wrongs committed against Black people in Chicago.
Brandon, is that meaningful to hear that from the mayor?
I think it is meaningful to hear. I think with the reparations discussion, I'm always fascinated when city municipalities take on the issue, when really it probably should be more of a federal issue, because when it comes to chattel slavery, that is a deeply American crisis, not just one that one city or another is responsible for. I am curious how it's going to play out with the Evanston challenge. The idea that, you know, doing payments based off race is, you know, somehow a violation of that 14th Amendment. And I'm also curious what framework this reparations would look like. You may recall the Evanston one was more targeted toward housing and helping with mortgages. So it may not be direct cash payouts. There may be other ways that you can have reparations and support for Black Chicagoans. But how do you actually deem who qualifies for that? Is there going to be genealogy tests? Like, those are the big questions.
Redlining. Who knows?
That's what this task force really has to get down. And I do admire the fact that it looks like this task force has a framework that's realistic to try to actually make public results.
And meanwhile, Illinois getting going on a reparations commission as well, but waiting a month for that. Now, we don't know what is going to go forward with reparations, but change for sure coming to Chicago, in the sense that for the first time ever, an elected school board, at least partial, is on the horizon. So, Rima, I turn to you. You were at the Board of Elections voting site early week when hopeful candidates lined up stacks of papers to file their petitions. What was your impression of the candidates that you spoke to?
Yeah, so it was my first time covering that kind of petition day in Chicago, so it was very, very interesting. There were 21 candidates who eventually filed on Monday their paperwork. Now, this is paperwork that's required to get on the ballot for November 5th. They need at least 1,000 signatures, but no more than 3,000 from the districts that they're running in, from registered voters. People in line were excited, generally. You had a ton of first-time candidates. One person stuck out, Grammy-winning songwriter and rapper Rhymefest, who has run for alderman before. But besides that, there were a lot of first-timers. They were there with their family members. They were there with campaign staffers, with stacks of documents and just ready to file.
It is work to run.
But absolutely.
What issues did they say that they really want to get on the board to try to address?
Yeah, it was a huge range. I feel like the common thing I heard was funding. Right now, CPS is facing a almost $400 million funding deficit. They've also changed how they're funding schools. So lots of people brought that issue up. I think people just want to boost academic achievement, too, is something I heard a lot.
And how big of a deal, Jake, is moving to an elected school board? Again, this is right now only partial. So mayoral control remains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, mayoral control remains, and that's a huge deal. But it's going to be really interesting to see what the actual school board looks like. You know, who controls the power there? And you know, eventually, when it's a 21-person board all voted, you know, like, who's backing candidates and who's winning elections? It'll be really interesting to see if it's the Chicago Teachers Union, if it's school choice advocates, who wins there.
Both. And we'll just see how much money. That's my guess. Yeah. Now, new out today, the U.S. Supreme Court has a decision that allows laws that would keep guns out of the hands, Hannah, of alleged domestic abusers. Now, this comes as advocates in Illinois have been pressing for legislation that would really do just that. So is this likely to change things, this new ruling? Is this likely to change things in our state?
It definitely adds a lot more oomph to the folks who have been pushing this. You know, this dates back to last spring, and then tragically last summer, there was this horrible death of this woman, Karina Gonzalez, in Little Village, and her teenage daughter, Daniela. And so the bill was
killed, by the way, or murdered allegedly, yes, by an individual who she had an order of protection against but still had a gun.
Exactly. And so the bill, it had failed last spring in the legislature, and it was dubbed Karina's bill in her honor. There was a big push before legislators went back to Springfield in October for veto session. Didn't happen. There wasn't a ton on it this spring because in the meantime, this U.S. Supreme Court case was taken up, and so people have been kind of waiting to see what the court had said. And so, but as you said, 8-1 ruling today saying that, you know, taking away guns from folks with domestic violence or protection against them does not violate the Second Amendment. So, you know, we saw some statements out today from the folks who have been backing this, who have been pushing for this. And I definitely think that there's going to be yet another big push before lawmakers go back to Springfield after the election in November.
We'll be able to use this as a reason for not passing, sure, that law now that the ruling is out. Now, also out of Washington, President Joe Biden issuing an executive order that potentially offers a pathway to citizenship for really hundreds of thousands of immigrants who have lived here for at least 10 years and are married to a U.S. citizen. Now, Rima, what prompted the president to do this now?
I think that there's been a lot of concern about families who, you know, we have many people from the southern border coming in to big cities in the United States. And I think there's been some concern about what kinds of protections can there be for folks who have kind of settled down here, made this their home. And he recently issued, you know, he's working towards securing the border more so and earned a fair amount
of the opposite side of
this is the opposite. So I think it might be a bit of a response to that backlash. That's me speculating a little bit, but I think that stands to have a lot of impact in Chicago too.
A lot of impact in Chicago. How, Brandon?
Well, you have families here who likely are citizens who have family that are not. So this is a big relief for them, especially when you have so many that don't have homes, don't have places to be, and feel kind of lost in this new city they're in. Hopefully this adds some relief for some people there.
Including one of the members of Congress,
exactly,
from Illinois. We're talking, of course, about U.S. Representative Delia Ramirez, yeah, whose husband is a Dreamer. Now, sticking with the issue of migrants, Jake, the Latino caucus calling on Mayor Johnson to end the eviction of migrant families from city shelters after that's been renewed and happening now with those who have children in CPS schools. Did this push by the Latino caucus change anything?
You know, it might have actually. It's hard to tell so far, but the mayor's administration did tell me that they want to reverse this policy. They do want to, as long as there is capacity in shelters. And keep in mind, with shelters so much lower now, there are over 4,000 beds available right now. So as long as there's capacity.
Then why have people been moving out if there are beds? Is it just the shelters that they're in?
One more time.
There have been some families that have been moved out. If there are 4,000 empty beds.
Yeah, so they did start this policy last week. You know, they did start to evict families after previously allowing them to have exemptions. But after the Latino caucus pushback, the mayor's administration, you know, they do want to allow for exemptions to continue. They need permission from the county and the state right now. I asked the mayor's administration again today, hey, have you guys heard back? And I got no response. So, but there is an effort, at least in theory, from the mayor's administration to follow the Latino caucus's will here.
All right. Well, we will. I'm afraid we are out of time.
All
we'll
good,
continue to
good.
Follow that or try to get to that in just a moment. Our thanks for all of their insight. Brandon Pope, Jake Sheridan, and Hannah Meisel. We are back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. The Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by Tonight's presentation of Chicago Tonight, Week in Review, is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown, and the Mullenhauer Progressive Philanthropic Fund, in honor of Ida Mullenhauer, supporting quality journalism.
And that is our show for this Friday night. Don't forget, you can get Chicago Tonight and The Week in Review streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and on our website, WTTW.com/news. Now for The Week in Review, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe and cool, hopefully. And have a good night. Now I know what you're going to be doing, at least for part of the weekend, Brandon, watching the sky play the Fever.
It's going to be a fun Sunday. 3 p.m., the last Indiana Fever Sky game, the highest, most watched game in 23 years in WNBA. So that's huge.
And you spoke with the Sky's, one of the Sky stars.
Yeah, Angel Reese. She's incredible. She's got a consecutive streak, 7 straight double-doubles, the most for a rookie in WNBA history. She's balling. Doing great right now. And of course, Caitlin Clark, you know.
I know you'll be watching this weekend, waiting to see who else files by Monday. That's the deadline for...
Yes. That's right. I'm going to wait until Monday to do that, to log on to the website.
You're not going to spend your weekend waiting and refreshing. Weird that.
Yeah, it should be interesting. We'll see what the field looks like by then.
How many candidates are you predicting?
I think it's going to be about three dozen.
Three dozen.
Yeah,
okay.
Although I'm hearing about people who have kind of already dropped out, potentially gunning.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, which is proud to honor founder and senior partner Robert Clifford, who has been named in Forbes 2024 list of America's top 200 lawyers.